Up next, from PopTech 2005, a presentation by Yochai Benkler in the session entitled Participation Revolution from IT Conversations. Hello, this is Doug Kaye, the executive producer of IT Conversations, and today I'm excited to bring you another presentation from PopTech 2005, held October 19th through 22nd in Camden, Maine. Registered members of the Conversations Network receive a wide variety of benefits. For free membership or to help support our efforts through your donations, visit conversationsnetwork.org. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at limelightnetworks.com. And now, here's our presentation from PopTech 2005.
I'd like to welcome to the stage Yochai Benkler. Yochai has been thinking about the economics of open source, the economy of sharing. And what we see is this idea going very far afield from medicine and healthcare, to the way we think about industrial applications, to the way we think about globalization. And he's going to share with us where he thinks this idea is going to go next. So it's my great pleasure to introduce to all of you, Yochai Benkler.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. I guess after Davy, I'm the boring relief, but I'm used to that, given that I'm a law professor, which means I make lawyers for a living. What I want to talk about is a fundamental transformation in the economy and through it the society. And one thing to keep in mind is the second quarter of the 19th century. This shows the change in cost of starting what is understood as a daily mass circulation paper between 1835 and 1850. Moving from something that is about $10,000 to start to something that's about $2.5 million. Something that you could do for all sorts of reasons to something that you need a business model in order to do, either through the market or through the state. What this creates is a stark bifurcation between consumers and producers. We have passive large audiences, a small number of professional, in our country, commercial producers. We have systems that are either market-based because they can raise the basic money necessary for the machines necessary to communicate, or the state, the other form that we can raise it. And this really characterizes and anchors the way much of the way we know the world for about 150 years. Another way of imagining the fundamental transformation is around June 2002, a major bomb was dropped. For the first time, the major fastest supercomputer was built in Japan as opposed to the United States, the NEC Earth Simulator. And about 2 years later, a sigh of relief, IBM had IBM Blue Gene. We just inched ahead of them. All the time ignoring the fact that throughout this period, SETI at Home was a platform that allowed 4.5 million people to share the leftover computer cycles of their PCs to create a much faster supercomputer, because that doesn't count. It's not a big machine in a government lab built by a large industrial player. It's something that happens and can happen because millions of people have equipment that they can use while sharing to produce something that we're only now learning how to harness. So what is the networked information economy? We always think of the information economy. I think we need to start thinking about the industrial information economy. That's one that's organized around capital and around the needs of the industrial economy, and the networked information economy. Central to it is radically decentralized capitalization. Computation, storage, and communications capacity are all radically distributed in the population. We now have somewhere, depending on whose numbers you believe, between 600 million and a billion people around the planet who have all the necessary physical means in order to make and communicate information, knowledge, and culture. So here's a curious situation that we find ourselves in. The most important inputs into the core economic activities of the most advanced economies are now widely distributed in the population. That is to say, computation, communications, and storage on one hand, and human experience, creativity, capacity to connect, wisdom, and insight, which is not something you can do by just changing one person from the other. Any one of you who has ever transferred a job from one person to the other knows that there are kinds of knowledge that you just can't put on a paper and say, here, now you're as good as I was. So knowledge is non-fungible, is personal, and that's the other thing. And again, it's in the hands of individuals. What this means is that things people have always done with each other and for each other move from the peripheries of the family, the household, the friends, the neighbors. Outside of the economy, they move into the core of the most advanced economies. And we're seeing two primary shifts, or we're seeing a shift that I've called commons-based peer production, but it's really composed of two things. One is commons-based production. That is to say, producing things where you take the inputs out of a resource set that no one says, it's mine, and you can't have it. No one owns it. And when you convert them into something new and valuable, you don't talk about your outputs as, it's mine and you can't have it. You might use it commercially, but through a relationship, through reputations, through something else, not by controlling it. It's a self-feeding commons where you take things that others don't ask you, don't need, that you don't need permission, and you give back without requiring permission. It can be individual, it can be done alone or collectively, it can be commercial or non-commercial. The other major development is that we're seeing large-scale collaboration in models that are not the market and not traditional firms emerging to be very effective. One of these is peer production. When we have lots of people cooperating, and I'll give some examples if it's now a little abstract, lots of people cooperating to make things together. And even though there are lots of people, the way they organize themselves is not, I'll pay $5 if you do this, no, I'll pay $6, not the price system. It's not, I'm the manager, you will do that, and I'll take care of it that somebody else will make sure that they do what you need. Not the firm, and not the market, but social cues. Here's what we're doing together. And the motivations also are not, I will pay you, but here's a reason to do it together. The other thing we're seeing, like we saw with SETI at home, is sharing of material resources, particularly communications capacity, storage, and computation. And the economics here are a little different, and I won't go that much into them. So this is the image that's in everybody's mind to the extent that they care about this. In the mid-90s, two groups of people thought that it was really important to develop a web server piece of software. One of them was Microsoft, and this was central because this was transition. The other was a bunch of people who needed a better piece of server, so they started the Apache project. 10 years later, one of these groups has 20%, and if I told you that 10 years later the volunteers had 20%, it would be breathtaking. But they're actually the ones with a 70% market share. It's Microsoft with the 20%. So this is a fact. It's not an idea. It's not about cheapness. Amazon runs Apache for its secure transactions server. It's about better. This is mind-bending because we, for 150 years, have thought of production as something you do through the market if it's decentralized or through a firm if you need to centralize it. Not that a bunch of volunteers connecting with nobody owning the thing will be able to outperform a leading major player. This is happening in all areas of information, knowledge, and cultural production, and I'll just give you a few examples so that there's a sense. NASA needed to map images that came from Mars. And a couple of people started an experiment to see, what if instead of having our fully paid PhDs do this, we would instead create these little images, put them out on the web with a very easy interface. You click on 4 points and we automatically generate a circle and translate that into a map. 85,000 people clicked here in the first 6 months. And then they measured things that they'd already mapped with the new things. Their result was that the automatically computed consensus of a number of people looking at each of these 2 inches was, quote, practically indistinguishable from that of a fully trained PhD. Same production problem, organized differently, and instead of the traditional model where you have to have a full-time paid person with a particular business model, in this case government-funded research, to something that people can do in their spare cycles, as it were, in the background, for reasons of, yeah, let's contribute to something bigger than ourselves. Let's contribute to social and scientific understanding of space. Encyclopedias. So if you go to Encyclopedia Encarta and you look for Barbie, this is what you'll get, right? The large wardrobe of this is it. This is the whole definition of Barbie on the thing that comes bundled for most families that buy a computer for their kids to learn. On the other hand, you have something on the order of 60,000 volunteers producing Wikipedia. And Wikipedia is the collaborative effort, completely open. Anybody who wants can come and edit, but anybody who sees a bad edit can edit back. And in a collaborative form, using this platform where people talk about it, you see a fairly detailed definition with emphases on the politics of the problems with Barbie, with emphases on the point that Barbie is in fact a role model for professional women as well, not just the thing you care for, which was all the other dolls, with a specific place to have a conversation about should we say this or shouldn't we say this? What's the meaning? A completely different conception of an encyclopedia, not only free, but participatory, where the meaning is something that is both transparent and negotiated among the participants. And of course, if you go to the Columbia Encyclopedia, what you find for Barbie is Barbie Klaus. I will say Britannica has as good a definition as Wikipedia and more tightly written. Yahoo, great invention, human edited directory to the web. We'll get human beings whom we pay to do this. But the Open Directory Project with 40 or 50,000 volunteers, each person, I care particularly about this. So this is online law journals in Yahoo, has been like this for years now. This is the Open Directory Project, a much more complete, because instead of having 500 people, 1,000 people covering lots of things, you have 60,000 people, each one spending a couple of hours a week, maybe a couple of hours a month, looking at the one category that they really care about. That's theirs, with some form of a peer review system. It's not only volunteer. When you think of Google's PageRank, what does it do? The single critical judgment that Google makes as a search engine is, what is most likely to be relevant to you, the person who's using the search engine? That judgment of relevancy, they are outsourcing to the web, to those people who are creating websites and linking to others. That's not the market, that's harnessing the peer judgment of people around the net as to what's valuable. By comparison, Overture is a search engine that actually you get listed based on how much you've paid. So this is a market-based decision of relevance, and we know which of the two won out. They're also not culturally irrelevant, because here, the first meeting, the first line is Barbie.com, but the second one is already Adios Barbie. It's already challenged. Whereas here, you'll go for a while before you run out of people willing to pay money for placement, and you will find Adios Barbie. So that's peer production of information. Now let's move to talk about material things. Data storage and retrieval. Imagine in 1999, a senator or a CEO would come up and say, here's what I want from you. I want a data storage and retrieval system that can service 100 million people around the world, that will be robust, it'll be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If people attack it, if you close down the main indexing server, if you inject malicious files, even if people send armed guards to major nodes in this data system, I want it to keep working and keep being available. You'd say years and years and years and millions of dollars. But of course, this is P2P file sharing. Forget for the moment the copyright question. Put that aside, because that happens to be an argument about the particular kind of data. I'm now talking about the fact that a distributed data storage system was set up for such a small amount of money that's been so robust around the world. We're seeing today, as we talked about distributed computing already in the context of SETI at home, we're seeing in the context of the development of mesh networks, the development of open wireless frameworks where you can over Wi-Fi overlay now algorithms where each computer will look up and say, hey, I'm not talking now, I can relay your packets. And you can actually have people building their own municipal cloud over an area with each of the machines transferring the packets when you're not talking. And we're beginning to see mix and match strategies. What's Skype? Skype is the Kazaa architecture where you share storage, processing, and bandwidth to create a voice over IP application that is enormously valuable to millions of people around the world already. With no one owning the infrastructure, everybody brings our own, and together we have a voice system. A fundamental shift in where capitalization comes from. So, if we think of the industrial period as having, largely speaking, three transactional frameworks in the economy, plotted along the lines of whether they're decentralized or centralized, and whether they're market-based or non-market-based. A decentralized market is the classic market, the price system. A centralized market-based production is the classic firm. Some decisions get centralized and put within management. A centralized non-market system, we also know, government, traditional nonprofits, the big NGOs. What's begun to develop now is this area of decentralized, non-market effective action, social sharing and exchange. And that has happened because it used to be that if you wanted to build a car, it wasn't enough to want. You couldn't come on Saturday morning for 2 hours, meet with your friends, and put together an automobile production line. But you can do it with an encyclopedia. You can do it with news reporting. You can do it with video clips. You can do it with information, knowledge, and culture, given the way that capital is distributed in society. So social sharing and exchange is emerging as a new modality of economic production. It's not that social relations weren't there always, but they were shunted to the periphery of the economy. Now they're coming straight in. We're seeing decentralized authority and capacity to contribute to effective action. I don't have to ask the property owner, may I? Because I can, as a practical matter. And we're seeing reliance on social information flows, organizational approaches, and motivation structures. And remember, motivation structures is really complex. We haven't really developed our economics well on this. But just think of two intuitive, or one and a, one and a, ch- one and a bit intuitive things. When you go to dinner with friends, and at the end you get up and you leave $50 on the table, do you increase the value of what happened? Will you be invited again more often or not? And if it's not so obvious for you with dinner, think of sex. Now, these new sources of behavior are creating new sources of competition for the market actors, but also new opportunities. The competition is easy to know. We see P2P networks, and we think recording industry and maybe Hollywood, and we see real clash. We see free and open source software, and we look at Microsoft, and we see real clash. We saw one person has 70%, the other has 20. That's competition. We see Wikipedia, and maybe not quite Britannica yet. There's too much value in the accreditation there. But Grolier and Encarta and the other 405 online encyclopedias, certainly. We see Skype and traditional telecoms. So we're seeing systems that built up both outside the market and in the market, pooling all of these resources to create new sources of competition. We also are seeing new sources of new opportunities. We're seeing a shift from well-behaved appliances that can be relied on, like televisions and CD players, to production tools, whose value is because you can produce, not only because you can consume, like PCs, handhelds, and wireless. We see a strict bifurcation between consumer goods and infrastructure goods, completely different market, into a meshing where you see things like Wi-Fi cards or Skype becoming things that consumers buy as infrastructure, new set of opportunities. We see finished information and cultural goods like movies transitioning to platforms for self-expression and collaboration. Things like GarageBand that allow you to mix your own music. Things like Craigslist that allow you to get together with people in all sorts of ways. Things like Technorati that allow you to search the blogosphere for what it is that people have produced as speakers. And the last thing we're seeing are the emergence of surfers. If you just imagine an old simplified model of a supply chain, you had a supplier, You had property and contract. You knew you would get these inputs, and you could commit to a customer for outputs, right? There's this almost linear, predictable, seemingly deterministic supply chain that's built on property and contract. Now, what do you have? You have this stuff will flow out of connected human beings, and the probability is sufficiently high that I'm actually going to commit to someone that I will deliver a service. It's a little scary. Not only that, I also have to put back things in. I have to make this community feel that when I'm using its outputs, I'm not in some sense screwing them. I'm not skewing the environment. This is a completely new set of skills, and yet there is value in it. If you look at IBM's revenues from royalties as compared to their revenues from Linux-related services over the first 3 or 4 years from 2000, green is what happened to royalties. Blue is what happened to Linux-related services. Right? So what does it mean? This cloud of people will produce an operating system, even though we don't own it, even though we don't control it. We contribute some patents under these circumstances. We contribute some people under that. But we're not owning the thing that's coming out. But now we're sufficiently confident that what comes out will be good enough that we can turn around and sell enterprise software services without worrying. Complete rejiggering of the boundary of the firm and what it is that counts as managing your inputs. So, social production is a real fact, not a fad. I would put it to you that it's the critical long-term shift that's caused by the internet. In some contexts, it's more efficient than markets or firms. It's sustainable and it's growing fast, but it's a threat to, and is therefore threatened by, a number of industries that have been around for 100 years, built around the high capitalization model. The most distinct threats at the moment are from Hollywood and the recording industry, trying to push what from their perspective is entirely sensible, strong copyright. But all that is trying to regulate in favor of an incumbent business model that continues to see the person at the receiving end of the supply chain as a passive consumer. And if there are people in this room who are sitting here who are business people whose business is built around understanding that people have new desires, new demand, new abilities, and that there are opportunities to serve those, either as platforms or as tools or to surf on them, then you should know there are political battles going on now that bring the stakes. Will you have a general purpose PC, or will every PC manufacturer have to sit down with Hollywood to clear hardware standards to make sure they enforce copyright? Can you develop any piece of software, or must it comply with a certain set of standards? What's the risk that the Department of Justice will come knocking at your door because you have built a piece of software that your users then used to undermine a 100-year-old business model? There's political action that's needed. I want to say a few words about politics, and I'll go through some of these much faster than others because I really just want to highlight. The critical point I want to get across is it's real, it's sustainable, it's predictable within fairly standard economic understanding given the change in capitalization. Now, what does it mean when in a democracy and in a global information economy, the critical inputs into information, knowledge, and culture now have a completely new transactional framework to build? To some extent, we see this as a matter of autonomy. We're seeing the shift from consumers to users. We see greater individual autonomy, not only for what people can do by themselves, but also what they can do in loose association with others. Some things, like raising a barn, we might not be able to do by ourselves. But being able to create a barn-raising community, at least in the tradition that we know, requires committing a huge amount to one community, which is constraining to autonomy in other ways. Here we suddenly have a new network through which we can connect with people for one purpose, just the encyclopedia, just the software, just these anime movie videos, music videos that we're making together. For this, we have a new connection, and then we go our separate ways and do something else, a new dimension of being effective together. So here's a fifth grade teacher from Gander, Newfoundland. If you do Viking ships on Google, you will find that the number one link, the number one site of educational materials on Viking ships is done by a fifth grade teacher in Gander, Newfoundland, in his spare time. This is a completely new way of being, as opposed to just buying. When we talk about democracy, we have an experience, all of democracies essentially, except for a very short period in the early American democracy and the early British parliamentary system, some small portion in the Netherlands, but generally, the transition to democracy has been already in the context of mass media. Remember, the shift to mass media comes with the electric press, comes already with high capitalization. What happens when it's new? So, if you remember, before the last campaign, Sinclair Broadcasting, which owns about a quarter of the households in the country, wanted to air a documentary about John Kerry. And it was called Stolen Honor, and it was basically like Swift Vote Veterans for Truth, but aired as a news documentary. The Kerry campaign stood up and argued and issued letters to the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Election Commission, nothing. But things started happening within the first 36 hours in the blogosphere. People started, what should we do? Let's picket them. Let's send letters to the FCC. Let's boycott them. Let's sign a petition. Within about 48 hours, two sites were set up. One of them, called Boycott SBG, started organizing actual practical discussions of, should we call the station manager? Let's call the national. Let's call the national advertisers. No, no, no. I tried it. The real person to talk to is the local advertising manager in the station. That's the person whose job is really at stake if we boycott. Here's another way of looking at the same data. On the first couple of days, people are beginning to talk. Right around the beginning there, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee and the Kerry campaign are arguing. Nothing happens so much to the stock that it wasn't happening the few weeks before. Then we get a few days of the boycott organizing, and around the end of that first week, as the boycott is actually rolling over, there's suddenly a Lehman Brothers warning that says, uh-oh, we may be losing revenues here because some local advertisers have in fact pulled ads. The next Monday, the stock drops. The next Tuesday, mid-morning, Sinclair declares, oh, no, 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 Stolen Honor, that's not what we're in. We're just having a little snippet and next to it commentary, and the stock goes back up and continues. It's a very new way of organizing politics, and it's a new way of solving problems. A different way of talking about this is the height of success of American journalism, the Pentagon Papers story. This is how the American public finds out about the failure of Vietnam. But the Nixon administration gets an injunction. The New York Times, with all of its power, sends over to the Washington Post. The injunction continues, but it hires a very good lawyer, and the United States Supreme Court pushes back the injunction, and democracy wins. Well, how does it happen today? Diebold is a major maker of voting machines. As you may recall, in 2000, there were a question or two about voting in the United States. And so in 2002, they began to introduce machines. Nothing in the mainstream media seriously challenged these, but a bunch of activists began to look for things, and they found some source code. Look at the structure of how this works. Here's the source code. Go look at it. Oh, and by the way, they might run after you, so replicate it in lots and lots and lots of places so they can't shut it down. Some of it might be password protected. Here are these nice people over here at lostpasswords.com that can help you with that. Some of them may be corrupted. Here are some people in Zip Repair who will help you with that. We don't have money to hire a reporter to look at this. Good hunting. Let's go together. In fact, one of the academics does this, Avi Rubin at Johns Hopkins, and this follows with media exposure of the findings of the problems that Maryland issues two required studies and issues modifications. If that's not enough, Bev Harris, the original activist, then gets a bunch of emails from inside the firm. That goes to Wired and says, can you believe that these people again had a security breach, but no study of the emails themselves? Harris tries to do the same thing with Let's Read the Emails, but this time Diebold brings an action under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, says they're ours, you can't have them, and this blocks the emails. But not quite, because there are a few Swarthmore students who've got them, and they're putting them up. Now Diebold knows what to do. It sends the college a piece of paper that says, shut that down, it's ours, and you can't have it. So they win, right? Wrong. Because by the time it's gone to the students, it's out there, and an entire ecology of freedom has developed that makes it very difficult to shut down. Some people are free software developers working on censorship-resistant networks like Freenet or free software interfaces to Overnet. Some are like eDonkey. They're commercial firms trying to serve what is basically an illegal taste for sharing. Some are users in other campuses. From these, the California Commission gets some of these emails that find that they're a problem in California, and very quickly, what we see is that many of the Diebold machines get decertified in California. There's also a court action that, in fact, the students win 1 year later, when it's much too late to affect the elections. Very different model. Finally, three words on justice and development. We live in a global information economy. The critical determinants of human development, life, health and life expectancy, education and literacy, and growth, are all dependent on research, on information, on knowledge. What we're seeing now is that more of what makes for human welfare depends on information, knowledge, and culture, and social production and peer production is beginning to produce the inputs we need. Software, textbooks, publishing, even in agriculture. So the scientific publication was all NIH, university promotion and tenure, and the commercial providers. Now we're beginning to see an ecology of web-based publication, non-proprietary commercial models, non-commercial models. We're seeing a platform like BIOS, the biological innovation for an open society, beginning to develop agricultural research, bringing in farmers, commercial players, universities, the public sector in to collaborate on agricultural innovation. We even see one person trying to put together kits for undergraduate chemistry classes so that instead of synthesizing well-known chemicals, they'll synthesize targets that might actually help with tropical diseases. Why not use these students while they're learning in lots of different labs to synthesize the molecules we actually need? So, technological threshold conditions enable greater individual human agency. They expand the domain of effective action for diverse motivations. Social sharing and exchange emerges as a major new modality of economic production. This creates new business challenges and also new business opportunities. But most importantly, it provides us an opportunity of negotiating a new way of being human beings, free, but also together. Thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation delivered at PopTech 2005, held in Camden, Maine, October 19th through 23rd, 2005. Registered members of the Conversations Network receive a wide variety of benefits. For free membership or to help support our efforts through your donations, visit conversationsnetwork.org. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at limelightnetworks.com. The series producer for our coverage of PopTech is Darusha Wame. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani. Our website editor was... My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for more of PopTech 2005 here on IT Conversations.